Hey there, you're listening to Filmed in Canada.
It's a podcast about Canadian movies.
If you enjoy what you hear, please go to the iTunes store and leave a review for us. It really helps us get noticed.
And if you'd like to continue the discussion, you can check out our Facebook page. Just search Filmed in Canada Podcast. And you can also reach us by email at filmedincanada@gmail.com.
And feel free to go to our website, filmedincanada.net, for our other content and to leave a comment.
Hey again, this is William.
And this is Chris.
Thanks for listening again to this thing we call a podcast. Good to have you back, Chris.
It's great to be back.
You chose today's movie.
I did.
What inspired you to choose today's movie?
Well, I just got back from Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, and I really wanted to do something regional from the Maritimes, so I chose Marion Bridge. That is all.
Great. Well, why not?
Why not?
Okay. So this is my first time seeing Marion Bridge. Mm-hmm. And had you seen it before?
No, I had not.
Oh, okay. All right. So fresh eyes on Marion Bridge, originally released in 2002.
And the directing debut, and I'm sorry in advance that I might butcher the director's name. I think it is Vibeke von Karelsfeld. And this was her first feature, though she has many credits as a writer and editor.
Also, is it the first on-screen role for Ellen Page?
It is.
Yeah. It's based on a play by Daniel MacIver. Do you know more about the author?
I do. He is an incredibly prolific Canadian playwright, and in 1998 or 99, I actually got to see him perform Monster at the Culch, the East Vancouver Cultural Center, and I had no idea what to expect, and it might have been one of the most incredible live theater performances I've ever seen.
Really?
It was incredible. Huge twist at the end, didn't expect it. It's basically a monologue where he inhabits all the characters. So it's just him on stage for the whole 90 minutes, and it is absolutely mesmerizing. So very talented playwright. He is a grad of Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. He has won the Governor General's Award for Drama in 2006. He has a recurring role on the Republic of Doyle television show as an actor.
Do they still make that?
I don't know. When I was in Newfoundland, I did see little spots where it seemed like Republic of Doyle had been shot there.
Right. Are there statues to Doyle?
Statues to Doyle, yeah. And he was also an actor in Twitch City, which was the Bruce MacDonald TV show that I think Dan McKellar was also in, if I recall correctly.
I think so. I actually thought it was a Dan McKellar, like, more of his thing.
Well, Bruce MacDonald was a part of it, too, so maybe it was a collaboration between all three of them.
Yeah, that creative community is pretty close, it seems.
I think so.
Do you have other attachment or background with the Maritime provinces?
Well, I lived in Newfoundland, Labrador, when I was a kid. So I went to grade 1, 2, and 3 in Gander, Newfoundland. And in the last 5 years, I've been to the Maritimes twice just for vacations. And I feel like it's a pretty special place, and I really like it a lot. And I could definitely see myself living in that part of the world.
Okay. I went there for a couple weeks vacation, a couple summers back, and it was a very pleasant time. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think many Western Canadians get to that side of the country. I think people go to California, they go to Costa Rica, they go to Mexico from here, but very few people travel the 8,000 kilometers from Vancouver to Halifax, St. John's. It's an epic journey, and it's very expensive, but I would recommend that every Canadian do it, certainly from this side of the country. It's really an incredible place, and it's very different than here being Vancouver.
The scenic drive on the north part of Nova Scotia, is that the Cabot Trail or something?
Yes.
Now, is that where Sydney, Nova Scotia is, or is Sydney mm-hmm. was on the other end?
Yeah, so it looks like this movie was filmed in Cape Breton in Sydney.
Okay. So it's that area is famous for its scenery and this nice scenic drive.
And it's folk art.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't get that impression from the movie, though.
The folk art?
No, about just the scenery or just like...
Oh, no, it looks very grubby.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit surprised. It's very careworn.
I was a little bit surprised that when I found out where the story was set, that it wasn't really my postcard impressions of what the place would be like.
Which I think, a movie that we talked about when this podcast first launched was My Bloody Valentine, which also took place in Sydney and was filmed at the Sydney Mines. Also, I think at that time I had compared it to like an Allentown, Pennsylvania. I mean, this is hard living, industrial, not picturesque. This is a grubby, careworn place with working class people. It is not a postcard for summer tourists. To me, I feel like you never really get to see this side of Canada. There's a few things I noticed in the movie. The car that Agnes was driving, and Agnes is played by Molly Parker, is a shitty, looks like a Ford LTD or something, and there's no rims on the tires. That suggests two things. One, that you drive a shitty car, and two, that there isn't a man in your life that would put the rims when you're changing from summer to winter tires, they would change out the rims too. So just that one detail to me meant there isn't a man in this household. Not that it has to be a man's job, but men have been known to change winter tires to summer tires and vice versa. But no one's done that because it's a household of somewhat checked out females who have other things on their minds.
Mm-hmm. I think Canadian movies, they tend more likely to show the worn parts of a town compared to like when you see like a Hollywood production, they really glam a place up. Even if it's like a little town, it's glammed up as like the perfect small town, or if it's in a notable city, you get all the landmarks. And it seems, maybe that's just like a budgetary thing, but it seems like more often than not in a Canadian production, you see the lived inside of the town.
Yeah, and I like that. I remember reading an article with director Alexander Payne, and one of the things that drives him crazy when he's watching a movie is that everything has this patina of newness and freshness when it's set deck for a movie. And he's like, nobody's car looks like that. People's apartments don't look like that. It's like no one lives there. It's like no one drives that vehicle. I like when there's some life in the things that you're seeing on film so that it looks like the things that you use every day. I mean, your house doesn't look like a museum. It looks like someone lives there. And I like that in this film, another nice touch was, I don't know if you noticed that they had furniture in front of the front door.
No, I don't recall.
So that's a formality that no one would ever use the front door. Huh. Maybe if you thought you were having company, but you would never go through the front door of that house. It's too formal. So everyone comes in the back door. I've gone to people's houses where the front door is basically blockaded because no one would use the front door. I don't know if it's a regional thing, but I've been to people's homes that, not in Vancouver, but elsewhere where it would be like standing on ceremony. It's like when her sister says, we don't eat dinner, we eat supper. So there's some class things going on in the fact that Agnes has left and gone to Toronto, and these are the country mice that still live in Sydney.
Well, that's I think that really kind of sets the stage for the story that we're examining today. Just as an aside, I mean, do you think as we talk about it, are we giving away anything crucial in the plot?
I think
there anything that you want to kind of like step lightly on?
I don't know. I feel like the movie's been around long enough. Mm-hmm. But is it unjust to let out the reveal?
Do you expect people who listen to this will want to see the movie?
Possibly.
Then do you think it's fair to keep some things unmentioned so that they can discover it?
That might be challenging.
Okay. Well, we talk around it, but
okay.
We'll try.
We'll do our best. It's also a play. Like, I feel like it's in the Canadian atmosphere.
It's based on a play. It's been available for 16 years. So we're going to be talking about this movie from 2002. We're going to get into some of the plot details right away or toward the end?
I think we have to give a synopsis.
Yeah, but...
But I don't think we have to reveal the thing.
Yeah. So toward the end of the talk, we might get into some of the reveals in the plot. I think it's just part of the texture of the movie and the story. So it's not meant to be a shock, I don't think. Also, That element is revealed right on the box notes for the DVD. So it seems like it's an upfront thing, and maybe that's also part of its history as a stage production. Maybe that was upfront as well. I don't know for sure, but listeners, so be warned, if you are really sensitive about preserving the secrets of a movie till you see it, toward the end of this talk, we might get into some of that. Chris, would you like to give us a plot synopsis?
Sure. This is a movie based on the play, Marion Bridge, about three daughters, sisters, of an alcoholic mother who has a terminal illness and is dying. So Agnes, played by Molly Parker, returns from Toronto to help care for her dying mother. She is in recovery and working her 12 steps. And the sisters resent her being there because she was the one who left and left them to deal with all the baggage. The mother is divorced. I think the father is remarried. And so it's really just the daughters and the mom as a family. And so there's a lot of prickliness between the sisters.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well. Chris, did you like it or not?
I liked it. I did.
I'm pretty cool to this one.
Cool like chilly? Like you didn't warm up to it? Or cool like okay?
Oh. I did not warm up to it. Yeah, I'm not really keen on recommending it.
Okay. Hmm. How come?
I felt that there was not enough sort of tension to keep my attention.
Okay.
Yeah. I felt that it was what it delivered in like the first 10 minutes or so was pretty much sustained. That was like the tone sustained through the rest of the movie. And it just didn't give me enough to stay connected with it, because I was waiting for something to develop that never did. I have a hard time with some stories that are just about waiting. And mm-hmm. and what's mainly happening in the movie is that the sisters are waiting for the mother to die. They're not really after anything in particular.
Right.
They're not trying to accomplish something. There's, in general, there's like their relationship that is strengthening. But I never really felt that they had a fractured relationship at the beginning. I felt that the characters tell us that Agnes is the irresponsible one, or the one
right.
who betrayed them.
Right.
Except they don't really seem that resentful of her in their actions. They're not.
There's not a lot of trust. They don't trust that Agnes is there for the right reasons, or will stick around, or is committed to this.
They say
they expect her to be as, you know, flitting in and out as she's always been. They're always left to do the heavy lifting.
And then Agnes does stay, though. She doesn't do anything she doesn't really do anything to confirm their suspicions.
Right.
So there was no problem with Agnes. She wasn't, you know, she didn't have any unpredictability about her that created any tension. She was just being, from what I observed, she just seemed like a dutiful daughter who was trying to make amends with her family. And there was a little bit of tension, but there was no open hostility. And so there was just not enough driving the story for me.
So if she, I mean, she was someone in recovery and she meets old friends at a pub.
Mm-hmm.
There was I really thought that she would actually fall off the wagon in a spectacular way,
mm-hmm.
which would bring real tension and drama, because it would be the predictable thing that you said, which is she's the one that's the loose cannon in the family, but she doesn't actually act out at all. She actually phones her sponsor in Toronto. I don't know if there's an understory that we don't quite know. I was reading about the movie and they said that she was sort of an out of work actress, and I don't know if I ever heard that or observed
that. I didn't pick
that up. Okay, neither did I. So I wonder if her coming home is less about duty and more about no options.
Hmm.
You know?
Okay.
She's poor. She got kicked out of her last apartment. I'm making this narrative up, but is she home for desperation or out of duty or both? But you're right. She didn't have the spectacular failure that I thought she would over the course of the narrative.
Yeah. Let's back up for a moment. Do you remember the opening shot?
Remind me.
It's a perspective from underwater, I think. And the camera's perspective is someone trying to make it to shore.
Right.
And it seems like there's an undercurrent or riptide or something that kind of pulls you back out. And then Agnes wakes up from, I guess, a dream. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay. The opening shot of a movie, I try to pay attention to what the opening shot is to see, is there something being said about where we start our understanding of this world, right? And sort of the attitude of the filmmakers. It's the first chance they get to get your attention.
Right.
Right. So it was just a shot that, while I thought was kind of interesting in its staging, it wasn't, just because the murkiness of the water and stuff like that, it wasn't very visually appealing to me. And then I was waiting for that kind of a theme to come back to the movie, and it didn't. Again, if it was about Agnes and her being pulled under her vices or weaknesses, her impulses, right?
Right.
If it was about that, the movie wasn't giving it to me. I didn't see that tension about Agnes being tested. So I was left wondering, why have that opening shot? What did it really mean? What was it trying to say about the movie?
That if we had the flavor of that opening shot infused through Agnes's character, it would have been richer.
Well, just have some meaning to it.
Right, yeah. Okay.
So I just felt it was just a shot that, when all had passed, it didn't really say anything to me.
Right. So. Well, I didn't even remember that that's how the movie opened, so I guess it didn't come full circle and come back to me that tied up a metaphor neatly or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I do like, and I'll give you a chance to talk again very soon, Chris. when you said about how the other sisters... Teresa is the older sister, played by Rebecca Jenkins, and Louise, played by Stacey Smith. She's supposed to be middle sister?
Yeah, I think so, because Agnes is the youngest.
Okay. I don't know about that. I was going to peg Louise as the youngest.
She's grossly underwritten.
Hmm.
I kind of feel bad for her character. She doesn't get a lot to play with.
Yeah.
And I found her very frustrating to watch because I think they only gave her one note to play, which was kind of socially unavailable. I found her character to be very frustrating.
Mm, okay.
Again, not to reveal too much, that it is suggested that she is gay, and that is what may cause her to be so reluctant to sort of engage in the world because the world would not be accepting of her homosexuality. It is sounds like a very Irish Catholic family. So even Teresa says, I didn't want to have kids with my ex-husband, and that's a sin. So to not want to have children is a sin.
Hmm.
And you could tell that Rose, the mother, was just incredibly Irish Catholic in a lot of the things that she would communicate to her daughters as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could really see sort of the shadow of the church in a lot of the things that Rose would say and how she acted.
Yeah. I like the casting of these actresses, and the way that they interacted was believable as a family unit, I thought. I believe that they had that relationship as siblings.
Right.
And I liked that they portrayed this family in, again, kind of like a non-Hollywood movie type way. And it's not a Hollywood movie, but we talked recently about Lady Bird.
Right.
And there's an example of a mother-daughter relationship, but it's very a high level of energy between them.
Right. Right. Right.
And this is and while I think it worked well for that movie in terms of these two characters have that are very expressive.
Mm-hmm.
In Marion Bridge, I thought it was really believable as a group of siblings who have very low energy. And they interact in a very low energy way, and I thought that was very believable. And that's something that it was easy for me to kind of empathize with, looking at the way I interact with my family and my sisters. Right?
It's not all dramatic histrionics. It's often just a lot of unsaid things and lots of repression.
Yes.
Which I really, there's a scene where Teresa and Agnes are talking about the thing, the sort of the family secret. And Teresa says, "Is it my fault?" And Agnes begins to get glassy-eyed. And she says, "Please don't start, because if you start, I'll start. And if I start, I'll never stop." It's like their repression and their secrets are a finger in a dike. And if you take that finger out, then the whole family will just, they'll drown. So everything is bottled up so tight. And I think that's a recognizable family dynamic for a lot of people. And I liked that it was very buttoned up. I mean, they could snipe at each other, but there was an under simmering of repression that I thought was really well portrayed by the sisters.
Yeah, and something that they all do collectively.
It's
not that one is trying to break free of that of that behavior. They all have a tacit agreement that this is how things are kept in the family.
Right. Yeah. There's a part of me that wants Molly Parker, kind of like Michael Shannon. I want to see them do something that is so light and frothy. I always see them in very, very serious things. Like, have you ever seen Molly Parker in a rom-com? Being lighthearted and laughing with Justin Timberlake? No. Every movie, she is so serious and stoic. Even like in House of Cards, like she is just a steely character. It'd be nice to see her laugh and be playful. And maybe I just haven't seen any of those movies, but
I
feel like Molly Parker
mind.
Is... immediately. Serious.
So I think that's a good pairing you suggested, though. Michael Shannon and Molly Parker in a rom-com.
Wouldn't that be fun? I'd watch that. I loved Ellen Page's character. So Ellen Page, this is her first feature film, and she plays a character named Joni, who works in, as my sister-in-law would say, a shop of whimsy. So it looks like it's a folk art shop that sells the maritime equivalent of dream catchers. And I love how she's just such a tough little nut that, you know, a Vancouver 16-year-old would not look as tough as Ellen Page, you know, smoking Du Maurier cigarettes and just kind of guarded and cynical. I just love what a tough little nut she was for such a young, for teenager. She just seemed to be world weary. And I thought that was fun. This seems like the kind of community where everybody smokes and most people play bingo. You know, like that's just a cultural understanding that you start smoking at 14 and you often play bingo. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just a very sort of specific kind of Canadian upbringing.
Right.
Small town living.
Well, I'm on record as like really being against bingo.
Such a city elite.
Now, I don't know the source material, Daniel MacIver's play, but an aspect of the movie that really felt play-like or stage-like for me was that Teresa's ex-husband was not on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a movie should overcome that limitation. I would have liked to have seen a scene where Teresa has her own life away from the house, where she's trying to deal with the situation where she's divorced or separated, but...
Yeah, and he's got a new girlfriend who I think is younger.
Yeah, so she's dealing with that, and she's not quite over him. And actually, when he wants her help for something, she goes. Right? So, but she just reports it back to us. She reports it back to her sisters, and we overhear it in the scenes. I would have liked to have seen those scenes where Teresa has a life outside of that with her sisters. So that was... For me, as a viewer, it was a little bit frustrating that it was so interior to Rose's house, and you know there was just this hint of what Teresa was going through that we didn't get to see.
I think in the play, it actually all takes place in the kitchen of the house.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how Agnes's character sees Joni or any of that happens, but I just in reading about the play, it seems like it's like a little chamber piece that takes place in the kitchen. I don't know if we would need to see Teresa's ex-husband. If you think of the men that we do get introduced to in the story, it's not very many. I think it's really just the one friend at the bar who's super obnoxious and really sloppy drunk. When Agnes goes to the bar to visit some of her old high school friends, he's a total jackass. And then the father. I can't really think of any other men that come and go through the movie.
Hmm.
So I think we need to keep it just lady-centric. I don't think I want to know what happens between Teresa and her husband.
Well, it would be in keeping with the theme of the movie, though, if we did see her husband.
Another disappointing male figure?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So no harm, no foul.
Yeah, no, agreed. But this is like the Spielberg thing. Like, maybe you don't need to see the shark. You know the shark's there.
But I feel like I do need to see Teresa having more to do.
Okay. Yeah. Instead of just being the bossy older sister who mm-hmm. holds everything together and makes sacrifices, mm-hmm. is a martyr, essentially, and so sanctimonious.
Yeah. Because we see her through kind of through the eyes of Agnes.
Right.
And that's, it just limits what her, it limits the dimensions of her character.
Right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
There's a lot of things in the movie, though, that are hinted at. So, and you've spoken on some of them already, like Louise being a lesbian, and then Joni's relationship with Agnes is also heavily suggestive of what mm-hmm. their relationship is,
right?
And I think it kind of becomes toward the end. It's very clear what Joni is to Agnes, but Agnes says, but Agnes answers a question. Well, that even though Agnes doesn't answer truthfully, we understand what the answer is, and maybe Joni does as well.
Right.
I think it's very much in keeping with the tone of the movie that it's about unspoken secrets.
Right.
But there was, ultimately, there was one big secret that I kind of felt I needed it to be explicitly connected for my understanding of what the characters were going through.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And so I'm skirting around like a big reveal right now about the family. But you came to a certain understanding about the relationship.
Right.
Without that.
Yeah, though it isn't 100% explicit, to me it was certain. So that's what I understood it to be mm-hmm. when it is somewhat revealed.
Okay. Does it affect how you feel the sisters relate to their mother?
Yes.
And the knowledge of the reveal?
Yes.
Okay, so it reshapes how you think that they interact.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It makes, I mean, Rose is dying. She can't do anything now. I'm sure she has a million regrets. But the idea that three daughters would feel that loyalty and not a betrayal for a mother that knew what happened, because there's simply no hiding when this secret, you know, happens. So Rose knew. And I don't know if that was the impetus behind Rose divorcing or not being married to the girl's father anymore, but there's got to be some simmering resentment that Rose didn't do something to prevent this horrible thing from happening.
There's got to be, but the movie, I feel, doesn't give us that.
They're very gentle with Rose.
Yeah.
They're quite caring, and I mean...
So not until we get to like the deathbed
right.
confessional moment
right.
that the you know that point is really hammered home that you know she felt regret about what happened in the past.
It's not enough.
I guess I just feel like how the movie puts an emphasis on that secret kind of lessens the what we're witnessing as like what holds the sisters and the mother together.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be something deeper. So I almost wish that kind of a scene would have been dealt with earlier, because as Rose's final moment, it kind of makes like the rest of their relationship a little bit phony.
Right.
Yeah. Like I wish they would have like dealt with that and, you know, had some sort of a reconciliation over it?
Or even something, you know, a bit melodramatic, which is, it took me a long time to forgive you, Mom. Hmm. But we're okay now. Like something that it was even like, I fucking hated your guts for years. And that's why I left. And that's why I went to Toronto. And that's why I'm an alcoholic in recovery. Like something that acknowledges that you can't not hold Rose responsible. Mm-hmm. That's your mother. Her only job is to protect you. And she didn't do it. There's got to be something a little melodramatic about confronting your mother on her deathbed about this thing that the family has kept secret. There's got to be more rage, I think, or something, or even just contrition, something that the girls acknowledge, or especially Agnes, it took me a long time to get to this point to forgive you, or something.
Mm-hmm. An episode or two ago, Alexander and I talked about Indian Horse, and I commented, I don't like movies where the climax is about a secret being revealed, or a flashback that kind of changes your understanding of the rest of the movie, because I feel like it's a trick. Who are we a decade and change after this work has been published and received? Who are we to say like it should have been like this or should have been like that? I'm just saying I'm more interested in how characters deal with the aftermath of trauma rather than surprising the audience with trauma and then saying that explains a lot.
Well, you had, years ago, you recommended Short Term 12, and I don't know if you remember that Brie Larson's character had a hard time being intimate with the wonderful guy who was her partner, and then it's revealed later in the movie that she has some issues around intimacy because of something in her past, and that was just so perfectly dealt with in that movie. That movie is just a knockout. So there's ways that you can take someone through this. Exactly. What are the results of the trauma? How does the PTSD manifest? And it feels a little bit like this movie could have used a defibrillator just to sort of zap it a little bit to be a little more lively when it came to the secret, the reveal, and the feelings. Mm. We talked about enjoying the repression, but doesn't there have to be some...
But what are they repressing?
Right.
So... Yeah.
Yeah. What did you think of the ending? Or should we talk about the lunch that the girls have with their father?
Do you have something to say about the lunch?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't have any strong thoughts about the lunch other than, I mean, it was kind of, events led up to it as though it was going to be a climactic moment, mm-hmm. and with that in mind, I thought it was kind of disappointing. It was kind of anticlimactic climax.
I think it could have used the defibrillator as well.
Okay.
Though I like the idea that, you know, the monster doesn't have any claws anymore, so mm-hmm. the father is suffering from dementia, and so there's no way for anyone to get any satisfaction about a confrontation or, again, any contrition from him. The monster's fangs have fallen out, and he's just a hollow husk of a man who has dementia.
I didn't get any sense of when the last time they saw him was.
No. I have no idea if it's 25 years or 16 years, or I have no idea.
Yeah. So it was a little bit... it was hard to get like a good payoff from that scene because I didn't know what the sisters were expecting.
Right.
Like, have they seen him in the state already, or do they remember another time when they were afraid of him?
Right.
And now it's changed. So there was just like that contrast was missing.
The scene that is the last scene with the father, where Agnes sort of goes up to his face and looks into his eyes, just on the off chance that this is all put on so that he doesn't have to deal with the profound guilt that he should feel for being the monster that he was. And I like that moment that she goes back and looks at him again, like, is this real? Does he really have dementia? Or is this just a great way so that he can avoid acknowledging what he did?
Interesting. I didn't read the scene that way.
Oh, I did. Well, how did you read it?
I thought I thought I was seeing pity in Agnes's eyes.
No, is that fucker in there? Is he in there? Is that monster still in there?
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Let's talk about the ending then.
Interesting reading, though. The ending also was just not remarkable for me.
Far too tidy.
Also,
and idyllic in a way. Like, it was just too...
Yeah. It was... tidy is the right word, I think. Also, when the sisters approach the beach and they're carrying something, which is an image on some of the posters, actually, too, it made me think of one thing, and then it turned out to be, like, even less...
Was it a picnic basket? I can't even remember.
It was a picnic basket, yeah.
Oh, okay.
When I saw the image at first, I thought they were going to... I thought they were carrying Rose's ashes or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just a picnic basket. So it just kind of made the scene less...
a little too playful. Like, yeah. Yay, day at the beach. Yeah, okay, really? All right.
So have I talked you out of recommending it?
No, I still think it's... I still think it's a good kitchen drama.
Okay.
You know, since I have participated in this podcast, I feel like there's a certain tone to, I think, 80% of all Canadian movies where they're a little flat, where they don't have the dramatic highs and lows of like a Hollywood or even like an independent American movie. So there's a certain comfort to me, it's of just seeing this kind of regional specific family story told on screen. Does it blow my doors off? No. Do I recommend it? Yes, I do.
Okay. I think it's worthwhile that it is set in a specific part of the country. It's an interior look at a family situation. All that has merit. I think the performers in it are quite good. I'm just not excited by it, though. So, you know, it's not that I would, you know, warn people away from it. Right. I think I would maybe try to find another movie to recommend.
Yeah. What I noticed upon the opening credits was that it was a mongrel film, and we had just talked to Mina Shum a couple months ago, and her new film was also distributed by Mongrel Films. And do you know anything about them, that distribution company?
It's fairly new. Like after the 2000s, I think they kind of came on the scene, right?
Yeah, it was. I looked them up just because it seems like a lot of movies that I like seem to be distributed by Mongrel, and it was exciting to see Mina's distributed by Mongrel. It was founded in 1994.
Okay, so surprising. I'm already wrong. Go on.
And they did Blue is the Warmest Color, Taste of Cherry, White Ribbon, Oscar winners like Capote, Man on Wire, Amour, which you had recommended. It's a great movie. Canadian films like Deepa Mehta's Water, Sarah Polley's Away From Her, and Stories We Tell, which I think you guys talked about that. And one that you just talked about last month, The Manufactured Landscapes. So they are... I think the one, if you are a Canadian filmmaker, if you can get distributed by Mongrel, I think that is a pretty fantastic partnership.
Yeah, they seem like they're very active in Canada. Mm-hmm. That's great. And very active about promoting like the smaller titles. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we need to find a reference point to score this movie.
Oh, you guys and your scoring. It involves so much math and stuff.
Well, it's 10 one way or 10 the other. 10 points one way or 10 points the other. But we need a 0 point. And can you think of a similar movie about ladies, about sisters, about family? You haven't seen
Marvin's Room? That was a long time ago.
I don't know that.
Do you remember
one.
That one? Diane Keaton? No.
Yeah. You haven't seen the Japanese movie Our Little Sister?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thomas Vinterberg's The Celebration? Now, there's a reveal, right?
I don't remember.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Child abuse?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Usually it is.
Yeah.
In the movies, usually that's what's eating away at families.
Prince of Tides, that was also about that.
Spoilers for all these movies. Sisters?
Oh my god. I don't think Canada would ever make a movie like Sisters. I don't know if we can be that playful.
What's the one with Tina Fey and Amy Schumer as sisters?
Amy Poehler. It's called Sisters.
Sisters. Oh, I was thinking of the first Sisters I mentioned was Brian De Palma's Sisters.
Oh, that. Oh. Oh, okay. Well, my mind went to comedy.
I see. Well, we're going to do Comedy Sisters?
Comedy Sisters.
Okay, yeah. Let's go. Okay. All right. Did you like that?
I think I've seen it 3 times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it when I watched it. Different tone, but a movie about sisters.
Slightly right? Different tone.
Adult sisters. A little bit about the relationship with the parents as well.
Sure.
Do you want to use that as a reference point?
Okay. So then I give that something out of 10. Is that correct?
No. Well, Sisters is 0. And so you're going to...
This is where I get lost. Every time I hear you guys talk, I don't understand it.
Well, Sisters is 0 for however you feel about Sisters in your head.
But then...
It doesn't matter what I feel about it, but how you feel about it. And what I feel about it doesn't matter how you feel about it. But Sisters is the 0. And for me, Marion Bridge would be Sisters -4.
Oh my god. Like, I feel like you need a slide rule to do this new rating system. Does anyone know what a slide rule is? How old are the people listening to this podcast?
A slide rule. Isn't that when you go, ooh?
Okay. Sisters is 0 and Marion Bridge is, I don't think I understand. So if I said -2, no, but I'm recommending it. So that would be a +2?
No, it doesn't matter whether you recommend it or not. It's only by
I don't think
only
it needs to be this hard. I think I'm confused because how could a good movie be 0?
It doesn't matter if it's good or not. It's just a 0.
You're going to get so exasperated with me.
Well, we're not leaving until this is done. Running out of tape.
Okay, what? Sisters is 0 and Marion Bridge is, I don't know, 4? I don't get it. I don't know if that means anything.
+4. You like Marion Bridge 4 points more than Sisters.
No. Okay, then it's got to be minus. You said -4.
Yeah.
Well, then I'll say -2. Because I liked it better than you did. Mm-hmm. So it would be closer to Sisters than your rating. Is that correct?
That's how it works.
Whew. I am exhausted. I'm going to take a nap now. That was hard.
You're going to nap on that furniture in front of the front door?
That's right. Now that I've said that, you will notice a relative sometime in the next year that has things in front of the front door because no one uses the front door.
I don't have relatives in Nova Scotia.
They don't have to be in Nova Scotia.
I thought it was regional. That was a regional behavior.
Well, it's certainly small. I've seen it in small towns that I've lived in.
I'll watch for that. But I think I've moved it out of the way so I can get in the front door. So I can't see that.
Because you're special company. You're the VIP that gets to use the front door.
All right.
William's coming. And then carpet the comes.
Couch. Yeah. Okay.
They probably take the plastic off the furniture when you come to. But they leave the doilies on.
Well, tune in again and we'll have the good silver out for the next episode.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast again. It was a pleasure.
You're going to be regularly on the podcast, so it's not like
it always feels like a treat.
It's not like we're especially like, having you on.
It always feels like front door welcoming. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, William.